Welcome to Our Interesting Times with host Timothy Kelly, who interviews today's top alternative and revisionist thinkers.
May you live in interesting times.
My guest tonight is Dr. Eric Karlstrom. He has kindly agreed to return to the show to discuss his research regarding, global economy, globalism, and what he terms war via finance. That is a category on his fascinating website, 9/11 New World Order. Dr. Karlstrom is Emeritus Professor of Geography at California State University. He is also a musician. His other websites are Natural Climate Change and Eric Thor Karlstrom. Music, correct? Is that all?
Yeah, pretty close. Let me just run by those websites again, Tim.
Yeah.
It's nice to be back with you. The website we're going to be kind of working with and from today in this discussion is 911nwo.com.
Okay.
Which I have been, adding to over quite a long period of time, and it has taken. Different turns and moving in different directions. There is starts off Operation 911, then the next segment is War on Terror, should say War of Terror, and then War via Finance, and then the New World Order, UN, One World Government, New World Religion, the Controllers, Mind Control Cults is one avenue I've discovered, Directed Energy Weapons, Geoengineering, which applies to a lot of things, turns out. And so, these are some of the subheadings in that one. And then I've got a couple other websites, which you mentioned. One is naturalclimatechange.org, and one is my music site, erickarlstrom.com. And so this is what I do for fun. I play music, but then I feel a certain responsibility as a professor, former professor, to keep my oar in, as you might say, with some of the really important issues that our society faces. I also have a couple other websites. One's about the water issues in the San Luis Valley, Colorado, where I live. It's called San Luis Valley Waterwatch.com. And then I've just put together one basically with spillover articles from my 911nwo.com website. And it's called, it's got the snappy title of Gang Stalking Mind Control Cults .com. But it does tell you what's in there. We're talking about, kind of war via finance. And I put together this series of articles, basically reading others' work, trying to understand it for myself and for my students of a class called Human Ecology that I taught at Cal State University Stanislaus for, about 2 decades. And it became obvious to me that corporatism is a major, major component of our world now and our governance of our world and a major factor in all our environmental problems. And so to understand this beast of corporatism, corporations, I've gone into these areas and read some works and tried to distill what I thought was the most salient points from those various works. Works like Empire of the City by Newth in 1944, talking about the city of London. Works like The Globalization of Poverty by Michel Chossudovsky, a professor up in Canada. Things like that. And of course, I've got a lot of other books actually sitting on the table in front of me. The information's out there to be confronted and dealt with and understood. So I know you mentioned you've also done some reading in this area. So we'll see what we can come up with here.
Yes, so you can provide some sort of coherence or structure to a rather broad range, wide-ranging topic. But there's a succinct way of describing this, I guess, provided by one Noam Chomsky. Of course, I have differences with Noam Chomsky. I think he's kind of a leftist gatekeeper in a lot of issues. But he, nevertheless, he has some keen insights into these things. You provided a quote in the article where Noam Chomsky, in his piece, What Uncle Sam Really Wants, says that free enterprise refers in practice to a system of public subsidy and private profit with massive government intervention in the economy to maintain a welfare state for the rich. Now, that might have been somewhat contentious, I think, 20 years ago, 10 years ago. But after 2008, it was laid bare for all to see, right?
Yeah, even in the movie The Big Short.
Yes, The Big Short. Yeah, so that type of view is kind of generally accepted. It's not. I don't think we can any informed person or honest person could argue that's otherwise. That you know, obviously it's capitalism for the poor, well, and socialism for the rich. Now his choice, he calls private enterprise, free enterprise. Some people might call capitalism. You know, these are semantic debates we can have what we're talking about here. But I think you mentioned the term corporatism, and what exactly is corporatism? How would you define corporatism?
Well, it's almost the same as fascism. That's what Mussolini said. Fascism should be more realistically called corporatism, for it is the merger of state and corporate power. And we not only have the merger of state and corporate power, but the United Nations, which of course has been aspiring also to this, role of prototypical world government, is totally ganged up with the corporate sector in their projects as well. They talk about public-private partnerships, and they've used this very much to their advantage, in selling and using the environmental movement as a way to advance the agendas of the corporate rich. And the triad of power there is corporations at the summit, and then government, and then the third leg is non-governmental organizations, which are often sponsored by governments and or corporations. So that third leg is supposed to appear like that's the public part of the private public partnerships, but often it's kind of a ruse, in the sense that these are manufactured to reach common objectives. So then that can throw us into the whole realm of UN Agenda 21, now called UN Agenda 2030, which again would qualify as prototypical world government under corporate rule.
Corporate rule. Now that model, I think, developed out of the British Empire, correct? I mean, you established a corporation to colonize a country and give it special privileges, and
yeah. Well, so much of America is, it's been the Anglo-American alliance for well over 100 years, the British Empire, you might say, has been, kind of superseded and replaced by the American Empire, the American century being declared in 1941. But it really is, it's all tied up together. The CIA, comes from OSS, Office of Strategic Services, which was actually, all those people were trained by British intelligence, MI6. And so in a lot of ways, the American system is first a subsidiary of the British Empire and then a competitor or a joint partner, you might say.
Yeah.
So I would still think in terms of the Anglo-American alliance. And then, of course, we need to factor in the Nazis with the World War II and everything. And Joseph Farrell has written extensively on that, the Nazi International. But from my reading, and this is in a extended article I put together called Corrected History, which is also under the War Via Finance. Corrected History is reviews about six different books or excerpts therefrom. And the title of the article is London, quote, Jew Money Kings, Nazi Cartels, The Protocols, Zio-Nazis, Anti-Semitism, American Traitors and Illuminati Families.
That's the complex reality we're dealing with.
Yeah. There's it's riddles inside of riddles, you know, The Jews and the Nazis are supposed to be arch enemies, blah blah blah. And you read deeper and deeper into these revised histories with guys like Christopher Story, The New Underworld Order, and you find out, and others, I've got other books that also say the same, that the British talked about the German experiment and the Hitler project right after World War II. And then, of course, it was Wall Street and the City of London that created the German war machine through the 1930s and into the 40s that allowed World War II to happen. And the Nazi cartels like IG Farben, which were all ganged up and partnered up with the Dulles brothers and the Rockefellers and the Harrimans.
Yeah,
it's much more complicated than and the Bushes, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Prescott Bush was with Union Banking Corporation that had all these corporations that were German-American, and that were creating and funding the Nazis. So things are much more complicated. And then if you listen to Farrell, this Nazi International, which established quite a pile of loot during World War II, escaped largely to South America, you know, with Martin Bormann and the Reichsfuhrer and all that stuff. And then they operated out of South America, and they may still be a major factor in world finance and politics today. So
another criminal faction.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, a very powerful one, and you know, it's kind of anybody's guess who the top factions are. But if Farrell makes the point that he thinks it's the Nazi International has been kind of running America. Well, certainly, you know, Operation Paperclip and NASA and the mind control experiments of the CIA. A lot of these do have direct ties to the Nazis. So you're right; it's very complex.
And you could say the Third Reich was the archetypical public-private partnership.
That's right. Absolutely. The prototypical fascist state that is the joint merger of corporations and the state. So and of course there were a lot of American fascists, very very powerful American fascists in the 30s and 40s. They were really on the side of Hitler all along, you know, including the Rockefellers and our financial elite. It's all very complicated. The dominant themes of corporate dominance in our world today, outsourcing of all kinds of government functions to private corporations, privatization would be the buzzword. The CIA, you know, and Homeland Security, and all our and our military. I mean, they're outsourcing many of their functions, perhaps a majority, to the private sector. And, of course, the private sector would be much more concerned with making money than they are with, say, protecting the rights of American citizens.
And the same with the development of private prisons, with the Correctional Corporation of America, I think, And I just listened to a talk with Catherine Austin Fitz with Greg Hunter on American Watchdog, his show, and she was talking about public it came out that these corporations were charging $155,000 per inmate.
Yeah.
And
wow.
Up from like just under 20 grand, the expense to you. So it's a huge transfer of wealth. And what she gets to into sort of this is a huge embezzlement scam, like HUD, like the Department of Defense, with its $9 trillion it's missing, they can't account for, or what she discovered at HUD, which kind of started her on this path when she was Assistant Secretary of HUD. But all this money was being stolen because there's no one minding the store, no adults in charge.
Well, in the state of California, where I taught for 22 years at California State University, I started there in 1990 and left in 2011. The state paid for the establishment of 22 new prisons and one new campus of the California State University during that time. So that tells you where the state of California's priorities were. In other words, into prisons.
Yeah.
And of course, this is the prison industrial complex.
And the contracts require 90% occupancy, I think, in order to fulfill the contract. And so this affects law enforcement. You know, she claims, and this is what's really disturbing, chilling, is that police were going out and raiding low-income neighborhoods, minority neighborhoods, black, Hispanic neighborhoods, and just arresting people wholesale and so they could get people into the beds.
And of course, then they wind up
slave labor,
you know, doing menial labor and, you know, making pennies per hour. You know, and, you know, the little painted signs on the road, you know, chances are that's made with prison labor and that sort of thing.
Yeah. That's the same corporate model you get with Walmart and Target with the exportation of cheap labor overseas.
Yeah, let's face it. We're talking about slavery and corporatism in this sense. I mean, I've even read and heard that, you know, in 1860, the Civil War, you know, the elite, the ruling elite, the financial elite, had decided that, you know, slavery as it was practiced at the time in the South, where the slave master, you know, had to feed and clothe and house the slaves, was not such a good deal anymore. Better to pay individual slave wages and let those individuals fend for themselves in terms of food and housing. So that's the system really we've been under, and it's been refined and refined until I think the statistic now, and of course we're dealing with, you know, a population of 7.5 billion people worldwide and 323 million in the U.S., but about nearly 3 billion people live on the equivalent of less than $2 a day or $2.50 a day. So we're dealing with an economic system which, you know, is really very exploitive in the sense that it's a colonial system. It was supposedly going to replace the colonial system after end of World War II and all these third world nations supposedly got their freedom and got to write constitutions. But immediately then the U.S. mainly, you know, sent in the CIA or the troops or whatever and managed to co-opt the labor and resources of those third world countries by establishing dictatorships, which then would serve the quote-unquote national interest of America, which has always been defined by the State Department as the interest of the corporations, not my interest, not your interest. The national interest is the interest of the corporations. And anybody in the State Department would know that, and as I'm sure you know. And then, of course, national security, not to protect my security and your security, is to protect the security of this system, this corporate system, which often, you know, is all ganged up with the criminal element, you know.
Yes. And of course, that's illustrated best if you compare the American flag to the flag of the British East India Company.
Yes. Absolutely.
It's in your face. Yeah.
Yeah, the British East India Company is very, very pivotal in all of this, mm-hmm. you know, and it goes back to the 1600s, 1700s, and the exploitation, the conquest of colonization of India first, and of course, these individuals with the East India Company got filthy rich off of those ties, and then, of course, this very system has also been called Dope Incorporated because of the opium wars in China, in which the British forced drug dependence on the Chinese and were then able to, you know, dictate economic terms and create Hong Kong, for instance. But yeah, subjugate, in fact, one of the most powerful countries in the world, two of them, India and China, mm-hmm. at the time, were subjugated by this very, very clever British system, the British Empire, really, which is, as you say, more closely connected with the British East India Company than perhaps the British people themselves. Yeah, yeah. Much more. Yeah. Which brings it back to a small oligarchy, a plutocracy of very, very wealthy financiers, the City of London, the 677s, what is it? I think that's acres, but I'm not sure. It's very small. It's not even that big. Maybe about a square mile in the City of London, and it's own nation, and the Bank of England resides there, and the Rothschild interests reside there. So, you know, what you're looking at is fronts. You're looking at, you know, the nation state as front for these corporate interests, which are front for the family interests, which are often, you know, allied then closely with you know, Baptist minister Woolfolk points out in his 1890 book called The Great Red Dragon, this is Jewish finance. I mean, he calls them the Jew money kings. And, you know, you can, you know, it's real easy to miss that. I think it's, you know, there's a difference between knowledge and understanding. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those key elements. Here's what he says in his History of the Rise of the London Money Power. This is a Baptist minister by the name of Woolfolk in 1890. An imperialism of capital has grown up within the last two centuries from small beginnings until it is now the mightiest power that has ever existed on the earth. It is an imperialism mightier than the empire of the Caesars, grander than the empire of Napoleon in the hour of his highest glory. In comparison with it, all other empires sink into comparative insignificance. This titanic is the imperialism of capital, which I call, by way of distinction, the money power. The imperialism of capital to which I allude is a knot of capitalists, Jews almost to a man, who have their headquarters in the money quarter of London, the City of London, where bankers have their habitat. These Jew capitalists have succeeded in centralizing in their own hands the industry and commerce of the earth. They own almost all the debts of the world, the debts of nations, states, countries, municipalities, corporations, and individuals, amounting in the aggregate, it is estimated, to $75 billion, on which they are annually receiving about $4 billion of interest. They own the manufacture, shipping, and commerce of the whole world. They have attained control of the industry and trade of the whole earth, and are rapidly centralizing all business in their hands. These Jew money kings have established a grand imperialism of industry, commerce, and wealth, which is thoroughly organized and rules in the sphere of industry and trade with autocratic sway. Hmm. So in other words, this British Empire, which stretched all over the country of that, all over the world at that time, you know, had there were guiding philosophies and personalities behind it, which almost were perhaps invisible to the rest of the world.
But didn't Benjamin Disraeli, the Prime Minister of Britain, once say that we are ruled by personages which we never see?
Yeah.
Who was he referring to? I mean, that's...
Well, that's right.
And there was It was Disraeli who negotiated the British takeover of the Suez Canal, and he did that without Parliament. How he did it without Parliament was borrowing the money from Rothschild.
There you go.
So collateral deep to offer, and Disraeli's response was the British state.
Wait, now say that last thing again.
When Disraeli met with Rothschild to borrow the money to buy the stocks to get control of the Suez Canal, Rothschild's question was, "What collateral do you have?"
The
British state. And
right.
Through debt, we know this through Carol Quigley and his work, is through debt and bank finance, a very few people, banking families, which are predominantly Jewish, can control the governments of the world to do their bidding.
Right.
Now, whether or not, there's other factions that aren't Jewish we have to consider, I guess, in this criminal cabal. But nevertheless, there is a ethnic component to this that you cannot deny exists. It has to be considered when analyzing the machinations and true meaning of what we call the New World Order. So.
Well, I would say that it's, once you know this little tidbit of information and you start looking, then it's everywhere apparent. For instance, during the 2008 and 2009 financial meltdown, who were the spokespeople? Well, we had Hank Paulson, who was Secretary of Treasury, who had been with Goldman Sachs, who was Jewish or is Jewish. Ben Bernanke, head of the Federal Reserve, who is Jewish. Larry Summers, who some position high in Treasury, who is Jewish, on and on and on.
Yeah.
All the principals making the decisions about where this TARP money is going to go and how much it's going to be and how the whole game is going to be resolved. The people in positions of power and decision making just happen to be Jewish. And then if we look at the movie The Big Short, which is more recent, but also discussing the same time period, we'll see that the people who created the crisis were also Jewish, the Wall Street financiers who were gaming the system. So, I mean, the rest of us, after a while, we start to feel like spectators.
Mm-hmm.
We're not at the table. We're not in on the decisions. We're not in on that loop.
There's an interesting illustration of that power that in which you refer, because up until 1948, there was no Jewish state, but somehow
right.
they got their state, and it wasn't
right.
by accident. Obviously, power muscle had to be flexed to get that done, and it wasn't just the trauma of the Second World War and the Holocaust narrative, although that was greatly aided the Zionist mission. In fact, it was probably crucial to it. But prior to that, you had the Balfour Declaration, which was
right.
Negotiated or created by people like Chaim Weizmann in Great Britain, who was his financier. But it was secured by him promising that he'd exert influence with his Jewish friends in the States to get America into the war. And that was done because Woodrow Wilson was surrounded by people like Bernard Baruch, Jacob Schiff, I think Hans Morgenthau Sr., Brandeis and these people, and they had
and again all Jewish, and just from a different era. Now you're talking World War I era,
yeah.
And the big financiers, the big decision makers, the big movers and shakers, in terms of establishing the Federal Reserve Act, the Federal Reserve System, in terms of creating the Bolshevik Revolution, they're all Jewish, and again the rest of us are. Kind of standing by and responding, dealing with it, and of course dire consequences to the Russian Revolution, the Red Terror and ultimately the destruction of millions of.
But as early as 1919, okay, this is before, this is 1918. There's a book I read called State Secrets by Leon de Ponsin, written in the 70s.
Oh, okay.
And I think I'm pronouncing that right. It's correctly Ponsin. Yeah, Leon de Ponsin, State Secrets. And the early part of the book, it's called the Landman Document. And in it, this is probably 1918, 1919 that this is being written. And He says, it was under these conditions that the Anglo-American Zionists published a threatening warning to the British government by means of the Landman document. Remember, this is the British Empire, the most powerful entity, you know, in the world at the time, the biggest empire of the world. They control quarter of the world's surface, land surface. This addressing the British government as if they were speaking to an equal. They said, in effect, this is the threatening letter that was sent by American Zionists to the British Empire. You forget that you did not give us Palestine as an unsolicited gift. Balfour Declaration in parentheses. It was handed over as a result of a secret bargain concluded between ourselves. We have scrupulously observed our part in bringing America into the war on your side. We call on you to fulfill your obligation in turn. You are aware of our power in the United States. Take care that you do not attract hostilities of Israel. Otherwise, you will come up against grave international difficulties. Now, this is 1918.
Yes.
So
So even then, it was considered a nation by the Jews, by the Zionists. Theodore Herzl, who was head of the World Zionist Congress in 1897, defined what Israel was. He said, this came out in Henry Ford's book about the international Jew, the world's foremost problem. He said, now quoting Herzl, the Jew, he said, what is Israel? Well, we can define the Jewish as the Jewish race. Wherever there are Jews of that race, that's where you that's Israel. So it doesn't matter what country they're in. It can be in any country in the world. The Jew, wherever he exists, is a component of the state of Israel. So in other words, by that definition, Israel exists everywhere. And what unifies the Jewish people, according to Herzl? Well, what unifies them is the threat or the hatred of a common enemy. And who is the common enemy of all the Jews? Well, it is non-Jews. It is the Gentile. It is the Goyim, which is the Jewish word for cattle. So they are unified by their hatred of all non-Jews. And that even at that time, they were living in other countries. So they're living at the good graces of the nations which, you know, accept them, and yet they're unified in their hatred of their countrymen. So this is, you know, why they've tried to corrupt and destroy every nation they've ever been in, and why we see what we see now in the United States. Because, you know, I listen a lot to Tex Mars, the Christian preacher, also 22-year Air Force veteran and author on this. And, you know, he's written a lot about this, and he's had the courage to write about it, even though it is extremely politically incorrect. but basically, there's officially about 15 million Jews, which number stays relatively constant through the decades, and I'm sure it's radically underestimated, probably 10 times that or more in my guess. But anyway, supposedly about 7.5 million or 18 million Jews total, 7.5 million in the United States and about that many in Israel, and then the rest dispersed throughout the world. I don't believe those figures. I don't think you can believe the Jews on anything, especially their numbers. The point is that the United States is almost half the Jews in the world are in the United States, and the United States then has become their fiefdom. I mean, through Wall Street and New York and you know, their control of Washington, D.C. through all the lobby agencies, AIPAC, et cetera, you know, secret societies.
It's referred to as a Latter-day Sanhedrin.
Pardon me?
It's been referred to as the Latter-day Sanhedrin. These
what's the Latter-day Sanhedrin?
You know, like ADL and
PAC
and, you know. Yeah. And it's obvious if you look at American foreign policy, you know, I think if you even look at the American culture, it's the tail wagging the dog here.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And if you look a little deeper, you see that the Council on Foreign Relations was formed in about, 1921? Mm-hmm. And it was kind of the American branch of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which is Britain's roundtable group Now, both of these would have been originally controlled by Jews. And, you know, today 80% of the CFR's, whatever, 5,000 or 6,000 members are Jewish. And then the CIA and the intelligence agencies basically take their cues from this unelected body, the CFR, and, of course, also to some extent the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderberg Group and various others. But the CFR especially seems to control American foreign and domestic policy with their, you know, with their journal Current Affairs, et cetera. For instance, Huntington, I think it was Samuel Huntington, wrote an article, Clash of Civilizations, mm-hmm. back in the 80s, in which he predicted that, you know, the Christian world would clash with the Muslim world, and you'd have this, you know, dramatic series of wars. Well, that's exactly what has been orchestrated, and guess who benefits? Qui bono? Well, the Jews get what's left, you know, when the Christians and Muslims get tired of killing each other, then the Jews intend to take what's left, you know. So I think you can make the case that, you know, all this war of terrorism that we have, which, of course, is just a continuation of the war on communism, which, you know, kept all the corporate military contractors going during the Cold War, you know, to the tune of $9 trillion during that time period, which is more than all the other aspects of the American economy put together. Of course, we've had a war state, a combined national security state.
Yeah.
We've been on a war footing ever since World War II, and deliberately so, because, of course, that's what keeps the economy going. And then now with the war on terrorism, which, again, totally fabricated by the CIA, et cetera, we now have an excuse to invade whatever country we need to for resources or whatever strategic goals, to get rid of this group. We'll call it ISIS, we'll call it Al-Qaeda, we'll call it the Mujahideen, all of which are created, of course, by CIA and Mossad.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a very interesting, you know, system here. We want the resources, we want global hegemony, and a good way to make sure that we get it is to have wars in those areas in which we control. We either put in a dictatorship that delivers the goods to us, or we go and control it ourselves, like Afghanistan and Iraq. Yeah, so your turn, Tim.
Yeah, I mean, this takeover of U.S. foreign policy by the Zionists, by the Jewish lobby in the United States, it probably, I would say, became more obvious in the 60s after the Six-Day War, into the 70s and the rise of neoconservatives in the Reagan administration. But it's occurred in the past, you know, other, you could look at the British takeover of American foreign policy in the 1930s, the British cultural takeover. You could, you know, with the Quarter Circle, Hollywood was working with the British, and with the Roosevelt administration around to the Second World War to kind of get America behind the British Empire. And, of course, behind the British Empire has always been the Philo-Semitism and the British Zio Alliance, which dates back at least as far back as Oliver Cromwell. So it's hard to figure out who's at the top of the pyramid in this relationship, but nevertheless, it's up there, high up the pyramid. But get back to the economy and how this relates to the global economy being manipulated, being turning into a rigged system. We're talking about corporatism. Of course, I think things like the Cold War and the War on Terror is itself an expression of corporatism, of opportunism, of profiteering, a sort of a worldview. We saw that with, you mentioned the Cold War, and that was National Security Member 68, I think, which came out in 1947, 48, which called for a continuous wartime economy. You know, and then you had the report from Iron Mountain stating such a thing, that in order to maintain societal cohesion, stability, you need constant fear. Of course, the Cold War was good for that, but they even, you know, thought of things like environmental catastrophe, alien invasion. But so that's what we're dealing with. We need constant fear, constant strife to maintain the system, because that creates the markets. It frees up the resources for the global corporations for them to monopolize. Get back to how the economy is being manipulated, at least, I guess, internationally, is the whole idea of globalization. And, of course, I'm going to quote Noam Chomsky again. Of course, he's Jewish, but nevertheless, he has some...
Which is why he's a tremendous gatekeeper. I mean, he's blind on the Kennedy assassination
exactly.
And on 9-1-1, yeah.
But he says, I think you provided a quote in your article about the global economy. He says, globalization, he describes it as a fancy way of saying that you export jobs to high repression, low wage areas, which undercuts the opportunities for productive labor at home. It's a way of increasing corporate profits, of course. There are two important consequences of globalization. First, it extends a third world model to industrial countries. In the third world, there's a two-tiered society, a sector of extreme wealth and privilege, and a sector of huge misery and despair among useless, superfluous people. The second consequence has to do with governing structures. So, I mean, that was a great way to describe what's happening, because what's happening is that an economist will call this externalities, external costs are being exported to the third world. So there you can pollute, you can exploit political situations there, which create cheap labor. I mean, people being forced off the land. This goes back to the enclosure movements in England, but it's been a standard practice in Latin America, where local cadillos, I think they call them in Latin America, where local elites would seize the land and then become kind of do the bidding of the American corporations, you know, like United Fruit, things like that.
Right. Now, yeah.
Or in Cuba was a good example of that too. Cuba, you know. So at certain levels, you're dealing with people being forced off the land, being forced into the cities. So you create crowded cities where then you can put factories and pay them 50 cents an hour. Right? I mean,
yeah. Well, of course, that's all a big part of globalism and corporatism. The maquiladora zone, as you know, just on the south border of the United States with Mexico, where the assembly plants are for all our TVs and whatnot. It's so interesting for me to hear, the rhetoric from, the good old boys from wherever saying, get these immigrants out of here, get these damn Mexicans out of here. I taught in the Central Valley of California, where, of course, they were heavily exploited for agriculture,
mm-hmm.
And not only that, but the Mexican-Americans are generally very nice people, and they're hardworking.
Mm-hmm.
And if we were to, export all our legal and illegal aliens, I think California and other states would shut down in about a day and a half, because they do so much work, for low wages. But I was thinking maybe we should talk about these words neoconservative and neoliberal, because it's a fascinating juxtaposition of policies which have brought us to where we are now. And I think we have to see them as part and parcel of the same grand design, to concentrate the wealth of the world into a few hands. Of course, our neoconservatives are, the people that ran the George W. Bush administration, also the Obama administration, and they are mostly Jews. They came up with, and these are former Trotskyites, like
Crystal.
William Crystal, yeah, and Irving Crystal, his father, was a Trotskyite, and Richard Pearl,
Prince of Darkness.
Prince of Darkness, yeah. But yeah, I mean, this very, very small cadre, maybe 40, 50 people, including, Jeb Bush and Dick Cheney, who outlined a project for a new American century think tank, a plan in about 1999, which basically called for a new Pearl Harbor to galvanize American support for a series of wars of aggression in the Middle East, which, of course, serve Israel's objective of creating greater Israel, which, David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel in 1948, said, we want all the territory between the Nile and the Tigris-Euphrates in Eretz Israel, or greater Israel. Now, we're starting with a small little toehold, but we're going to grow, and we're going to take, this part of the Middle East, and then we're going to take the whole world, by the way. And it's this Jewish utopia idea, which very much is one world government, new world order. I've discovered. And, well, you know, you look at the Israeli flag, you've got the two blue bars. Well, those do represent the Tigris or Euphrates on one side and the Nile on the other. So the neocons, the basic, you could sum it up as imperial expansionism for Israel, leading wars that fit Israel's policy, and they've gotten America to be the strong man to do that for them, it seems to me. Although, you know, certainly American corporations benefit from oil, and Bechtel was over there, you know, running the country for a while, as was Halliburton and various, you know, insider corporations. So it's all kind of a package deal. But then, okay, so that's the aggressive militaristic side. But then you look at the neoliberal agenda, the neoliberal reforms, the golden straitjacket, the Washington Consensus. Chomsky talks a lot about this. He's got a book called The Washington Consensus and Third World Fascism. Now the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization, and whatnot, all these lending agencies kind of subjugate and victimize third world countries by their loans, development loans, in which the country becomes quickly indebted. And in order for the loans then to be, a new loan to be made, they have to adjust to certain demands from the lending agencies called structural adjustment programs, which says you have to sell off your public assets and utilities to private corporations, you know, usually for pennies on the dollar. You know, a whole standard list of structural adjustments need to be made to your economy. Well, that's what keeps these people in third world countries, you know, making $2.50 a day or less. In other words, it's these economic arrangements coming out of the World Bank and the IMF and whatnot that go back to post-World War II, 1944, the Bretton Woods conference, right up to World War II, right at the close of World War II. And so we have the neoliberal on the one hand, which I'm sure is run by the same interests as the neoconservative. But one is war via finance. That's the neoliberal. Mm-hmm. And then one is war via, you know, bombs and shock and awe. And
they both serve each other, too, yeah. Both.
They serve each other, yeah. So you know, Paul Wolfowitz, you know, goes on to be head of the World Bank, right? He's assistant secretary of defense, and of course a major neocon, warmonger, hawk, along with Reagan and Rumsfeld.
Where is it? The World Bank? Do you think he killed more people at the World Bank or at the
Well, and Zelig, you know, Robert, yeah. Robert Zelig, another Jew. These are both Jews. Zelig was one of the principal figures, probably in the whole 9/11 plot. He was also very predominant in the 9/11 Commission report. So very handy, you know. You write this, you write the version of history that you want, you know, which completely covers up the reality of 9/11. Mm-hmm. Well, Robert Zelig also went on to head the World Bank.
There's a revolving door that you mentioned too, with these eight, whether it's WTO or IMF, World Bank, or DOD, where they go from, you know, Department of Treasury, they go from the Treasury to back to Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan, and it's all the same people.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And Robert McNamara, when he was through killing Vietnamese, he went to go where? The World Bank.
Perfect example. That's right. He was probably the first. He was Secretary of Defense.
Yeah.
And he, like you say, he was very much involved in the Vietnam War execution and planning, and also involved in the tremendous firebombing destruction of
that's right, Japan. Yeah.
Of Tokyo and Japan at the end of World War II. You know, and of course the. You know, I mean, it gets very, very dark. I mean, these Pentagon plans to see how many people they can destroy, how fast, and what the impact's going to be. It's just a study, you see.
Well, I think in our previous interview, we talked about, of course, Alan Dulles, how his career. Dulles brothers are so illustrative of this system. But another one is Clark Clifford, who wrote the National Security Act. And
right.
Same time, he's Secretary of Defense. Then he gives in the banking, and he's, of course, gets late in his career, he gets involved with the BCCI scandal. sort of exposed at all what BCI kind of laid bare of what all this is. It's about finance, drug running, arms trading, and this dirty bank. And at the end, Clark Clifford finally, you know, he's near his end days at that point, and his name gets besmirched a little by that. But of course, he never went to prison for it. But that's just another example of how these people go into banking, high finance, and the government. They serve in the Treasury or DOD, because it's all related, you know.
Yeah, very, very, very much. And it almost reminds me, this is kind of taking a step sideways, but you look at the Jeffrey Dahmers, you know, the serial murderers and whatnot, that are, you know, they're coming from, many of them are coming from rich established families. And they can fulfill any of a number of functions for those rich established families. They could be, a spy. They could be a serial murderer. They could be a Hollywood star. They could be a number of functions. And of course, now we're talking about the Illuminati bloodline family, and they are thought to be satanic. And so the individual who's in that family could be drawn on to fulfill a number of the functions that needed to be fulfilled. Likewise in government, which then becomes, I think, the kind of the projected execution arm sometimes of what these families, these extremely wealthy Illuminati families like the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and whatnot, they control them from kind of behind the scenes. Now you look at the Bush Clinton nexus. Well, obviously they're all ganged up together, right? I mean, it was during the George H.W. Bush presidency that Bill Clinton was governor of Arkansas and was allowing all kinds of drugs into MENA, Arkansas, that the CIA was flying, from Central America, and then over to San Francisco and Los Angeles to fuel the crack cocaine epidemic of the 80s, and also fund the illegal war in Nicaragua. Well, so even in the 80s, of course, Reagan was president, but after the assassination attempt, his VP, George H.W. Bush, was exercising much more control. And then, of course, George H.W. Bush got his own four-year term. So in effect, almost he had a 12-year presidency, but and then later on we see Clinton and Bush, working for the relief, quote unquote, of Haiti, and then pocketing almost all of the donated money, like 96% of the money that the Clinton Foundation got, they kept rather than passing it out to the survivors of the catastrophe. Of the earthquake,
and now of course development projects like a luxury hotel and an automated factory, which only employed like 30 people instead of going to employ like 2,000 or something, and who knows where the money gets skimmed off? I mean, it's like it's
well, obviously the Bush family goes way back, and it's one of these major families, you've got four generations now of Bushes that have been involved in this war complex, going back to the father of Prescott Bush, who's from Connecticut, to his father is Samuel Prescott Bush, I believe. And he was in the War Industries Board for World War I, and he sold, certain size weapons to both sides of the conflict. And, these families are mighty profiteers in the war industries game, and they're also, of course, fulfilling other functions
alluded to some of these charities, and they claim that 10% only goes, or whether it's 40% or even 80%, even if 80% went to charity. How do you define charity? Is it going to a charitable organization which pays people, $500,000 a year, your friends, and you know how these foundations operate? They can hire friends and all that stuff. And some of the most profitable entities around are nonprofit, like the United Way, right? The scandals that came out of the United Way. So, I mean, there's so many things you can do it. But it's basically the money never gets to the people who are suffering. They enrich these organizations that whose directors drive around limousines, have, you know, huge expense accounts, and, you know, so it's just a huge, it's just, again, the whole charity angle is another reflection of, I think, of sort of the rigged global system that we're talking about, you know.
Very much.
And you see it because the conditions in Haiti have not improved, and where'd the money go, you know?
Yeah. Well, apparently, I listen to Alex Jones sometimes, and he says 96%, you know, was kept in the Clinton Foundation. In other words, it was just ripped off and used for something else.
I mean, that goes back to with the Rockefellers, right? The whole foundation thing is how you – the PR thing.
Right.
Also, it's a way that you can exert more control of society, because through the foundations, you can hide from taxes, of course, but you can also get it into things like funding education, like the General Education Board, which sought to impose compulsory education, create standardized education, create workers, not thinkers. You can take over the universities through endowments, which they've done, or start your own universities, right? You can take over, you can direct medicine, the development of medicine in a certain way, the allopathic, you know, petroleum-based medicine, and marginalized alternative care, alternative research that doesn't, you know, profit your particular industry. Take over the arts, and once you take over the arts, you can, like, marginalize classic good art and promote modern art, and pursue a cultural agenda of degradation, and promote feminism.
That's right.
And that's
the World Council of Churches.
Yeah.
World Council of Churches is another Rockefeller project, you know. So in other words, there is a long-term agenda of these people, which is, I'm afraid, Jewish utopia, New World Order, the Jewish Universal Empire, because the Rockefellers are crypto-Jews and the Rothschilds are certainly Jews. And the Bush is also apparently a crypto-Jew. So we need to see that these components feed into that larger agenda, which, you know, could be advanced by any number of their puppet projects, such as the UN or the corporations themselves, or even the United States government, if they so desire. Because, you know, again, it's like each of these organizations has been so co-opted and infiltrated by the moneyed interests that want this objective. This world government system, one world government, one world religion, they're relentless. This is what they spend their time working on. But there's such a confusion of other issues that we miss that big picture element, which is why I guess I'm trying to, you know, focus on it a little bit.
Yeah. Now, one of the documents which I think exposes this, which a lot of people refer to, but it deserves to be called out or attention drawn to it, because it revealed the plan. And this is the infamous NSSM 200, National Security Study Memorandum 200, penned by Henry Kissinger in late 1974, which called for controlling the populations of the lesser developed or developing nations, the third world, if you will, because they threatened United States. It was the population growth in the third world was a national security threat to the United States, and therefore, the United States should develop policies that limit and reverse the population growth. And how that was done was through war, debt, misery, starvation, disease, more or less.
Yeah, you know? There's a role for the neoconservatives and the neoliberals.
Yes, see that right there, and that's what. And if you look at the policy. It's been exactly that, whether it's the Middle East or Latin America or I mean, I think Asia went through it big time in the 30s when the Rockefeller supported Mao and his efforts in destabilizing Asia. That also might explain much of the Vietnam War, because prior to America's involvement in Vietnam, of course, it was a French colony, but it also became was no longer. It became dependent on food aid, and now it's a workshop for American corporations producing goods.
You know? Yeah, and you know we laugh, but you know there's a lot of tragedy and human suffering involved in this in this grinding poverty. I've been to Guatemala and I've traveled a lot. You know, I've felt it kind of my job as a geography professor, although I was usually using my own dollar and my own vacations. But I've been to Guatemala 5 times, you know, where the main cash crop is something like, you know, coffee or bananas. And the last time I was there, I got, you know, the information or the sense that, you know, the economy in Guatemala, which is always bad, one of the two poorest in the Central America, was even worse than usual, because the workers in Vietnam are making $1 a day, and those greedy workers in Guatemala wanted $3 a day, and that's with the whole family working. So, you know, the jobs were going to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's the race to the bottom of global corporatism. The corporations go for the cheapest labor, and they have no commitment or loyalty to their workforce whatsoever. If the conditions change, they'll move their factories somewhere else where they can exploit people for even less. And, of course, one of the reasons that, you know, I've done this research is because I've traveled to those countries, and I like those people. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the idea that U.S. documents call for the population reduction in countries like that outrages me, makes me extremely angry. I don't think the American people ever voted to be the empire. I don't think we ever voted to reduce populations in the rest of the world. I mean, we have a rogue government acting on behalf of the, you know, plutocracy, the ruled by the wealthy, the Illuminati families, whatever you want to call them, the aristocracy, the pedophocracy, if you want. I mean, a lot of them are pedophiles.
Mm-hmm.
The pathocracy, the ruled by psychopaths, if you want. In other words, the people that are controlling the system are doing so without input or the knowledge of the American people, which is why I continue to kind of try to do what I can, because to educate, because I don't think the American people would agree with so many of these policies if they understood the impacts of these policies.
No, it requires too much time and effort for most that most people are willing to give to these things to sacrifice what leisure time they do have. They'd rather be, you know, amused by reality TV and Dancing with the Stars and professional sports to think about what's going on in the rest of the world. They live in a bubble here in the United States. Even as conditions deteriorate here in the United States, life is still relatively very, very good. And it's hard to get people to notice these things. But yes, if you look, I mean, if you consider what's been done in, just in Latin America, whether it's Guatemala in 1954, when the United Fruit Company got the CIA to take out the Arbenz regime because he had nationalized some of their idle farmland to give it back to the people, which had been stolen generations before, or the efforts in Iran, and you know, with when they installed the Shah for the benefit of the Western oil companies. But you point these things out, and you just get a blank stare and say, well, you have to do it because you have to protect America's way of life, you know, our way of life. These things are necessary. You have to go out and steal and murder. What type of – you want to live that way? Is that your justification? You know?
Well, I mean, you know, from the Buddhist point of view, there's this thing called karma. And from a Christian point of view, you know, you reap what you sow. So,
yeah.
If it is conscious and knowledgeable, if American people are kind of in agreement, and I don't know that they are, but if they were in agreement that, yes, we need to go bomb these countries to oblivion so that we can get their resources, then this country deserves whatever fate, mm-hmm. you know, is in store for it. But if they are not knowledgeable about it, then, you know, I guess the goal is to educate. What's your call on that?
Well, I think what they do with this is where you create these boogeymen like Osama bin Laden, you know, or
right.
communism, because this justifies the destabilization efforts. I mean, this justifies. I mean, people still don't understand what's going on in Syria, where it's the effort to destabilize a sitting government because of that the Assad regime, I guess, nixed a pipeline deal. And also the fact that it's been traditionally been, you know, Russia's ally in the area, and it's also this also part of a wider plan, which again I think is backed by large part by Jewish organizations to destabilize the area and input these refugees or migrants into Europe to destabilize Europe, or at least to create the image of destabilization, because that destabilization itself or the image of it can have a lot of economic and geopolitical effects. Some people speculate it's a way to weaken the euro and prop up the dollar for a few more years. And there's a lot of agendas going on here.
Can I add one? According to Tex Mars, I think is it Hezbollah that Syria has provided refuge for, or is it Hamas? One of the groups, that actually defeated Israel in Lebanon.
It's Hezbollah. Yeah.
Hezbollah. Yeah, I think it's Hezbollah. Is gotten sanctioned to stay in Syria, and according to Mars, who again 22 years Air Force officer and a real expert in geopolitics, he thinks the main reason we're now contemplating a nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union, or at least saber rattling, is to punish Syria for their role in giving sanction to Hezbollah. Again, we would be just doing Israel's foreign policy for it.
Yes, there you can see that. What,
as a proxy.
Yeah, there you in the Middle East, you see the Odon-Yanan plan being born out in reality there. And the U.S. government seems to be carrying out for the Israelis. The idea of destabilizing the area, breaking up these Arab states and creating microstates so the Israel can expand and rule the area. There's no
That's
better
right.
example of that there.
That's right. And then meanwhile, the fallout at home here is that, okay, you have all these failed states and chaos and bedlam imposed on these previously stable countries that are mostly Arab in the Middle East. And then the U.S. government turns around and says, well, let's welcome these people as refugees or whatever into this country. Now we have this influx of people, some of whom are very, very, very angry and become terrorists here. So we actually fuel the terrorist cycle or the perception of the terrorist cycle.
And if they're angry enough, the FBI is there to create terrorist cells.
That's right.
But who benefits from that, right?
Pardon me?
Who benefits from that situation?
Well, of course, yeah, because if you're going to have all this money and, you know, the war on terror, you've got to conjure up some terrorism. Actually, the chances of Americans being killed in a terrorist attack or by a terrorist is about 1 in 20 million. I looked it up. Statistically, it's about the same as being killed by your TV set or your living room furniture. So they've got a hard sell. You know, they've got to keep us afraid of this boogeyman who is everywhere and nowhere. And so this, I'm sure, is part of the strategy to you know, I mean, the Department of Homeland Security, set up after World War II, after 9/11, I think it has a budget, something like, $60 billion a year, and has something like 200,000 employees, all to fight these, you know, almost non-existent boogeymen. So they've got to find some boogeymen. And then it gets a little deeper than that, in the sense that some of these shooters, you know, like the Aurora, whatnot, themselves, I think, are, you know, mind control victims of CIA mind control.
Well, yeah, if you doubt that, if you think that's off the wall or out of left field, insane, just look up Gladio, look at the Brabant massacres, and the idea of having either patsies or other people show up and shoot up an area just to stir things up a bit for political reasons. It's an old trick, so it's nothing that hasn't been tried before. And to say that they haven't modified it somewhat or, you know, put a twist on it, an American twist on it, and carrying out the same things here in the States for political reasons, geopolitical or domestic. Again, if you're not aware of that, just do your research. And it, unfortunately, it's nothing new. The Israelis excelled at it. I mean, if you look at the Levant affair, and that was a false flag. The bombing of the hotel
USS
there.
Liberty.
USS Liberty.
Oh, King David, yeah.
David Hotel was originally tried to they blame on Arabs. I mean, this is when the Israelis attacked American assets in Egypt, posed as Arabs, trying to blame it on Arabs to start a war, you know.
Yeah.
And there's always the, I think it was Victor Ostrowski who claimed that in his other side of deception, that Carlos, the terrorist in the 70s, Carlos, you know, what was his name? The Jackal. Carlos the Jackal was an Israel Mossad asset.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
He claims
okay.
That. And
Ari
Ben-Menashe claims that the Achille Lauro was a Mossad operation. You know, when
certainly
they,
the USS Liberty sinking or attempted sinking. Yeah.
And I think at the time there, Lyndon Johnson was sinking. It was one of his girls he was sleeping with was a Matilda Krim, who was a Israeli spy. And,
right.
You know, so, and he reportedly said when, you know, when the Admiral ordered planes to come to the relief of the Liberty, and McNamara gets on the phone and orders the Admiral to reverse the plane. He's like, well, I'm not going to do that. When the President gets on the phone and says, you better damn well do it. I'm not going to embarrass an ally.
Yeah, I recall reading about that. Another quote is, I want that ship on the bottom.
Yeah.
In other words, this is our president saying he wants an American ship to be sunk because Israel is bombing the hell out of it. Well, the ship didn't sink. And although many were killed, many survived, and they've lived, you know, some of them, many of them are alive today. This was 1967. And, well, they have quite a story to tell, don't they? And I think it was the Soviets who had a submarine in the area who came up, that came up and witnessed the whole thing, and that kind of blew the whistle on it because now it couldn't, they couldn't blame, they wanted to blame Egypt, of course, as a false flag for the sinking of the USS Liberty, but the Russians came up and saw that it was the Israeli fighters, the jets that were bombing and strafing it.
Yeah, I think it was a Russian satellites that proved that the claim that Saddam Hussein was massing tanks on the border of Saudi Arabia was false too, back
right.
in 1990.
Yeah.
Because remember, they claimed that he was going to, it was a prelude, or, you know, because he was the new Hitler, he had a mustache or something, I don't know. But he was going to march into Saudi Arabia. Of course, as it turns out, he had no plans. He was just correcting the border dispute with Kuwait and also the slant drilling issue, which the U.S. ambassador, April Glaspie, had apparently given him the green light to do. We have no position
right.
on this. You know,
that's right. Yeah, our foreign minister, State Department representative April Glaspie, told Saddam Hussein, "We have no opinion on your border dispute," which he Saddam interpreted as saying, "Okay, go ahead and invade Kuwait," and then of course he fell for the trap. So yeah, what we have is a country run by intelligence agencies, I'm afraid. The CIA, et cetera. And so that means we have elaborate cover stories that make it to the media. And then to dig down to the real story takes a little more work. But there are so many people trying to do it and so many books that are out that it's certainly not impossible to get the real story. I mean, you got the real story, and that agrees with the real story that I got. You know, so in other words, the sources are out there.
Mm-hmm. So, and this is what we're dealing with. The we get into you know how the global economy functions and for whom does it function, and this the policies of the U.S. government of the past at least 50 years, it's hard to come to some other conclusion that it's been the government's been taken over, you know.
Yeah, I've come, you know, there's a word, fifth column, you know, which of course is a Trojan horse. You know, enemy inside, and of course all our representatives and servicemen and whatnot take a oath to defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. Well, we have some real domestic enemies,
mm-hmm.
and I think we've been trying to shed some light on that. I think the names, you know, I mean, I've got this 911 site. I can name names now, you know.
mm-hmm.
Of course, there's been enough research. Of course, 15 years later. You know, we can name the names, and unfortunately, they are, you know, the vice president, the president, the head of the Joint Chiefs, you know, and the neocon think tank, the Project for a New American Century, and the judges, you know, who are again Jewish, who, you know, wound up with the cases of the victims' families and whatnot, who wind up, you know, bribing them with $1 million, and then you can't talk about this kind of
yeah.
thing. So, yeah, it's a very pervasive system that is controlling things from the top. And again, our Constitution wants power to reside at the local level and wanted to keep the federal government weak for obvious reasons, because the federal government can turn dictatorial, despotic, totalitarian, which, alas, is what has happened. But we can't ignore the influence of the fifth columnists, the Masons, the Jews, the secret societies, the foreign, maybe the Nazi International to some extent. The exact percentages mix would be maybe harder to nail down, but we can certainly pick out the major players and trace their influence over the last 100 years or more.
Yeah, certainly understanding the role of secret societies like Freemasonry, as the British obviously used it as a technology or a method by which they established and extended their empire, maintained their empire, through rings within rings, compartmentalization. That's how the intelligence agencies operate under, all of them,
right.
With CIA, Mossad, or MI6. It's a method to subvert and suborn foreign governments. It's how the British Whigs did this to destabilize the country. So when you talk about the secret societies, when we study things like political science, how governments work, how policy is formed, the history, you really cannot understand the history of the modern world without understanding things like Freemasonry, because the modern world is a Freemasonic creation.
Yes. Yeah. And if we look a little carefully and go to the experts, we find out that at its core, Freemasonry is based on the Jewish Kabbalah, which is a system of black magic that comes from ancient Babylon.
Yeah.
So, and many of the degrees and whatnot of the Masonic order are very Jewish,
Which makes it very uncomfortable to talk about, because in polite society, to point out that ethnic component in today's political environment is to invite censure and ostracism.
Well, this is true, but yeah. My feeling is these trends, these politically correct kind of unseen, unwritten laws will change. And we right now, what's the comment by Voltaire? If you want to find out who rules you, just ask whose name you can't mention. I think that it's becoming more common knowledge. And if you go on TexMarsPowerProphecy.com website and listen to his presentations, I mean, he's extremely informative on this. And the truth is the truth. So it can't be buried forever.
Nope. Well, listen, I want to thank you for coming back on the show. It was a wonderful talk. I think last time we talked for over almost 2.5 hours, but it was a broad topic. We kind of narrowed it this time. But your website has a wealth of knowledge in it, and information in it, and it's multi-layered. And perhaps in the future, I'd like to have you come back on, talk about some other dimension or some other topic you have on there. As I go through your website and read it, there's endless material there for rich discussion, I think. So hope you
absolutely.
Come
I'd,
back
I'd
on.
Be very happy to. Yeah, thank you for asking me to come back. It's we managed to talk about a lot of interesting things, and we're on the same page on many of them.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you. Yeah.
So thank you, and I'll what time was it? Like in the afternoon out there. So yeah, enjoy the rest of your afternoon.
Yeah. Okay.
Great.
You too, Tim.
Thanks
all
a
bet.
Lot. So long.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye bye.